Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Bethel Covenant Church podcast, where we host the latest sermons and other programming. You can also visit us on Facebook and YouTube to watch videos of our sermons, checking up with the latest updates, and to view further programming. If you'd like more information about our church, please visit our website at bethelcov.org. Thank you for listening to this program.
In the 246 years of our United States history, we have had a number of heroes. These include Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Martin Luther King Jr., Harriet Tubman, Paul Revere, Charles Lindbergh. The American War of Independence that was fought against the British also had a number of heroes: Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys, Francis Marion, known as the Swamp Fox, John Paul Jones, this famous quote, "I have not yet begun to fight." When we think about heroes in 2023, we think of Marvel superheroes. There are lots of characters, lots of different superheroes. They have made 38 movies of different Marvel superheroes. The top three being Iron Man, Captain America, Thor. Before all of that, we had mythical Greek heroes. Some of these included Prometheus, Icarus, Hercules. To be a hero means that a person or character is courageous and noble. Perhaps they've had some kind of special ability, or they've accomplished some sort of special feat, or they're known for their devotion or duty. Heroes are looked up to. They are seen as role models. There's something about them that we desire in us, or we're told to emulate or copy. And the Bible is full of heroes. Imperfect heroes, but heroes nonetheless. Some of the heroes are well known, and they are sometimes mentioned in modern society. Abraham, Moses, King David, Daniel, Esther, Mary, Jesus, Paul, Peter, just to name a few. And then there are some lesser known people in the Bible that we may not even consider heroes. We are going to look at this group of people, and they are the widows. A number of widows, stories about widows that we can say, that I am saying, are heroes. And I have described them as minor characters. While that may be true because there isn't a lot of written about them, their impact of their lives is not minor for us today. And the other reason why I say minor characters is we will see that they are only known as widows. They are nameless. They are nameless heroes. Verse 1 of 2 Kings 4. The wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that he revered the Lord, but now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as his slaves." So in this first verse, we learn a number of facts about our nameless hero. The wife's husband is dead, so that makes her a widow. The husband is from the company of prophets, meaning that he also was a prophet, someone we see directly that revered God. The husband's life was dedicated to God. He was in the company of Elijah, and he was a servant of Elijah. Elijah is one of those more well-known heroes of faith in the Bible. And yet, in this description of who this husband is, he died. We don't know why he died. It could have been from old age, as many men in that time and culture would marry much younger women. But I don't know if we can come to that conclusion just based on such little information that we have. My guess is his death is unexpected. For in the first sentence, we also see that there are two boys at home. And there are loans that need to be paid. If this widow was 15 when she married, and then 17 when she had her first son, and let's say it's 12 years later, that would mean that she's about 29 years old. And I'm just making up numbers here, only to paint the picture of the reality of the situation. Those numbers are, they're educated guesses. Those numbers are real numbers for women that lived in ancient Middle East. The two sons, she calls them boys. If they were men and grown, they would have been out of the house. They would have had their own families, and perhaps then would have had mom move in with them. But that's not the case. The first truth that we see from this widow is that hard times come to those who follow God. The husband was a prophet in the company of Elijah. The husband revered God. And so must have the wife, because she went to the prophet of God with her situation. Losing a loved one is hard at any time. Losing a loved one, when the loved one is the provider for the family, that only increases the hardship. And this is exactly the situation of the widow. Women in ancient Middle East did not just go out and earn a living. Men earned a living. And women, for all means and purposes, were possessions of men. Her children are boys. Boys do not go out and earn a living. Children were also seen as possessions. As boys age, they could help with income, but time was not on their side. The mom could not wait for her boys to grow up and start working and help pay the bills, because she's in debt. A debt that the lenders had wondered, where are these payments going to come from? The lenders had a plan. I'm going to take the boys and have them be debt slaves. We don't have debt slaves in our culture. For centuries, we haven't had that, but that was a very common practice. People could work off the debt. And that's what the lender's plan was. I'm going to take your boys, and they're going to be debt slaves. The sons may not have been able to earn a living as employees, but they could become debt slaves. They could work off the family debt. This solution, of course, devastated the mother. She had already lost her husband and is now facing losing her sons. There is a debt that needed to be paid. The hard times that she was in are about to get harder, unless something changed. We're still in verse 1, and the second truth that we see when hard times come is that we must go to God. This is what the widow does. She needs help. She knows she needs help, and she goes to God to get help. And the way that she goes to God is by going to Elisha. Going to others, especially when the others are people of God, is going to God. Now let me say that again. Going to others is going to God. Now, unfortunately, others may not always act in the way that we hope. But I am going to say, most of the time, they will. People will act that way we hope. Fear of rejection, fear of judgment, fear of shame, fear of appearing weak or helpless may stop us from going to others. We may say, oh God, just send them. They know. They must know. I'm sure that they know. But people don't always know. It would be nice if people did. And sometimes God does work that way. Someone may have an impression on their heart or their mind to go help someone or check in or offer assistance, which is great. And we need to follow through on those Holy Spirit promptings. Also, I know, though, that we can sometimes talk ourselves out of these promptings. Oh, that isn't really God, we tell ourselves. We say that thought or that voice is just me. They don't need help. They're just fine. After all, if they needed help, they would ask. And if they ask, then yes, I would certainly help. You see how this works? The person who needs help doesn't ask for it because they think, oh, they just know and they're going to help. And the person who could help doesn't offer help because they think, well, if they need help, they'll just ask for it. And nobody's asking for help, and nobody's given help because of that. So this is where our widow is a hero. She seeks help. It takes great strength and courage to do that. It takes great inner strength to ask for help, to admit that you cannot do it all. It takes courage to show vulnerability, to say, this is who I am, and I am a limited human being. I need help. Every person that has ever lived has needed help in their life, and not just here and there, but ongoing. And here's the first or second or third application question, my first overt application question. Where do you need help? Where do you need help? Where do you need to go to ask for help? The widow in this story needed financial help. She needed help to get out of debt and needed help to generate an income. In life, there are all sorts of areas where people need help. It could be with finances, but if it's not with income, maybe they need help with their financial future. Most people do need help to seek, to figure out, and to plan for retirement. Some people need help with basics in life: food, water, shelter, clothing, medical care. People might need help with yard work or house maintenance, car repair, shopping. When it comes to relationship in the U.S., both inside and outside the church, there is a 50% divorce rate. This tells me that people need help in their marriage. Couples may need help with their parenting skills, raising teenagers. They may need help knowing how to support their kids as they go off to college. Other areas of life could include help with finding a job, career development, writing a resume, job interview skills. And then there's faith. How does a person grow in faith? How does a person know how to follow Jesus? It's with the help of others. People need help in every area of life and in every stage of life. And our first thought here this morning is to be courageous and be willing to ask for help. So the widow goes. She goes and asks for help. Verse 2, Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" Elisha gives the response that the widow was hoping for. The response is one that we need to take on for ourselves, and that is to be ready to ask the same question: how can I help you? We need to guard against other possible responses. We need to guard against, when someone asks us for help, to say, not right now, leave me alone. Or to say, that's not my problem. Or to say, I'm busy right now. Or to say, let me pray for you. Not to say that prayer isn't important or needed or should be done, but do not use "let me pray for you" as a way to avoid helping someone. James 4:17 gives us this warning: if anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. One line that I started to use is, if there is something that I can do for you and I'm able to do it, then I will help. Over-promising and under-delivering is not helpful. And not helping is biblically incorrect. Maybe the help that you give is connecting that person to someone who can help. Can you help me with this? I don't know if I can, but let me help you find someone who can help. Going back to this response from Elisha, I think this may be the key to church growth. What if the people of God, the people in our church, responded this way when others came to us every time they asked for help. And our response is, how can I help you? How can we help you? It seems to me then, as people hear this, they would want to be a part of this church. Now, church is much more than helping people. It's about sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. But if that's all we did was verbally share the good news and did not help people, we would be missing out on what it means to be people of faith. We need to not only verbally share the good news, we need to live the good news. As we do that, as we continue to do that, there are lots of areas and ways that we are doing it, but as we continue to do that, and do that each and every time, people may wonder about the ministry at Bethel. And we can just sum up our ministry by saying, we help people. Tell me about Bethel. What is your ministry? We help people. This is our ministry. The rest of the story, verses 2 through 6, is the miracle story. Elisha asks her, what does she have in the house? And at this moment in the story, we don't know why he's asking that. Is he asking because he wants payment before he helps? Is he asking because he's going to tell her to sell something? Is he asking her to get a sense for who this woman is, her status, her place in society? Or is there another reason? As the story unfolds, we find out that he is asking because he's going to have her sell something. The woman's initial response to the question is that there is nothing at all. Another way to look at this question and response would be, Elisha is asking the widow, what do you have that God can use for his glory? And her response is, nothing. Do you ever feel like that? Do you ever feel like you have nothing to give to God? Nothing to offer? Nothing for God to use? It's tough to feel that you do have something at the lowest point in your life. Remember, this is the widow's lowest point in her life. Her husband is dead. The creditors are coming to take away the two sons. She goes to Elisha, asking for help, expecting, hoping, wanting, needing him to do something, just to give her something, perhaps to give her a handout, to give her money. And Elisha says, what do you have? Nothing. I have nothing that God can use. Not true. And here's the third truth in our story. Even in our lowest moments of life, there is something that we can give God for God to use, for God to be glorified. Here, too, we see an interesting principle about our human nature and the importance of dignity. Elisha could have easily given her money, given her a handout, but that would have robbed her a sense of worth and accomplishment. If he agreed with her and said, you're right, you have nothing to give, with the unintentional message being, you are nothing. Every human being has value, and every human being has something to give. And it is when we give whatever it is that we have to God, for God to use, we receive a sense of worth and can feel good about what is accomplished. God has designed us to work. Elisha knew this, and so he asked, what do you have? The second answer to the widow give Elisha is one small jar of olive oil. Perfect. Now we have something to work with. And watch what God can do with one small jar of olive oil. One small jar of olive oil is not enough to pay off the debt. It's not enough to live off of. And it may not even be enough to make one meal. But one small jar of olive oil is enough for God. Whatever you have, it is enough for God. And God can use it, and God can multiply. Not just add, but multiply to a level that we did not even think was possible. But here's the thing, though. We are greedy. Humans are greedy little creatures. So don't give what you have to God in order to get more. When our mindset is, I'm going to give it to God so I can get more, then we're really not giving it to God, are we? Giving to get doesn't work. Giving it to give, to see God glorified, that is the way we are to give. The widow did not know what was coming, but Elisha did. Get all the jars that you can and start pouring. And don't just ask for a few jars. Ask for all the jars that your neighbors have. If there is an empty jar, just keep pouring, because there is no end to what God can do. If there is an empty jar, then God can fill it. I don't have a lot of time right now, but I think there's like another analogy here between humans and God's Spirit. If humans are the empty jars and God's Spirit is the oil, then God wants to fill every human with his Spirit. This is a side point to the story. So here, the mom is pouring. She's working. She has value. She has worth. Her self-esteem is rising. There is a sense of accomplishment coming. You know, the story doesn't say it, but I bet she's crying. I just bet she's got tears coming down her face. How can this be? She says out loud. She's talking to God. She's talking to herself. She's talking to her sons. Look at this. How can this be a miracle, a real miracle in her life? She knows what this means. Jars and jars and jars of oil. All the empty jars that all of her neighbors have are now being filled with oil. She is going to be all right. This is the income. I can pay off my debt. My sons don't have to go into slavery. God has provided. Give me another jar, she says. No more jars, Mom. And then the oil stopped. She is in a state of disbelief. Again. She was in a state of disbelief before. This is what happens when a loved one dies. When her husband died, shock comes. She is in shock again, not because of what was taken from her, but now because of what was given to her. Even though she probably knows what to do, while being in shock, that means it's hard to think. It's hard to make decisions. So she goes to Elisha and tells him the oil stopped, and he says to her, sell what you need in order to pay off the debt, and then live off the rest. Live off the rest? Why, just how much oil was there? A lot. How much can God do in my life with what little I have, we ask? A lot. Notice what God provides for the widow. Oil to pay off the debt. God does not want people to be in debt. Financial, emotional, spiritual, or otherwise. This is the fifth truth. God provides freedom. Get out of debt, God says. The second thing that God provides for the widow is enough to live on. In this situation, God does not give more to the widow that he has provided for others, or more that he has perhaps in the past, but he just gives enough to live on. With that, though, there is an assumption that she makes sound financial and spending decisions. How much is enough to live on? Throughout these weeks, as we're looking at widows in the Bible, passages about widows, there's an underlying thought for us each week, which is, your life may change someday. And not just me, your life will change someday. Single to married, married to becoming a widow or widower, maybe being remarried, becoming a widow again, or life changes with a divorce. The sermon doesn't get into it, my message didn't get into it, but part of this widow's story is the role of credit. The widow was in trouble because of the family debt. If there is something that tragic happens to you this week, and it was just your spouse, would she or he be in trouble because of debt? Are you living outside of your means? Might you need help now? This nameless hero tells us that hard times come to those who follow God, who revere God. And when hard times come, we are to go to God asking for help. Going to others is going to God. She doesn't just pray to God, she actually goes to Elisha. Third, even in our lowest time of life, there is something that we can give God. Four, whatever you have, it is enough for God. And fifth, God does not want us to be in debt. And so, we come to the table. We come to the table looking for freedom, looking for help. The widow did not want to give up her sons. And that's why kids have parents, to watch over them, to care for them, to love and protect them. That was the right decision on her part. These are my sons, boys, at home, that I am to raise and protect and watch over and provide. I'm not going to give up my sons to the creditors. But this is what God does. He gives up his son. Jesus, as the Son of God, willingly comes. There isn't a struggle. God says, I'm going to send you. Jesus says, send me. I know. I'm going. Jesus knows the debt of sin that needs to be paid. And he's willing to pay it so we can have the freedom. Sometimes when we read these stories in the Bible, we say, well, where's my miracle? Where's all the jars of oil? How is God going to provide for me in that miraculous way? Your miracle, my miracle, our miracle is here, right here. Salvation for our soul. That is the miracle. Peace with God. That is the miracle. Freedom from sin and the penalty of sin. That is the miracle. God gives us a miracle through his son Jesus. And so we come to remember that today.